The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, entitled The Chmelnytsky Uprising and the Destruction of Polish and Ukrainian Jewry, is dedicated to the memory of Le'ilui Nishmas Chanachaya Bas Mendel Aleh HaShalom of blessed memory. In a previous lecture, we spoke of the Golden Age of Poland. Throughout the 16th century and up until almost the middle of the 17th century, Poland was the envy of world Jewry. It was famed for its Torah scholarship as for its wealth. This seemingly idyllic picture, though, was not without its flaws. Throughout this period, the Church kept on increasing pressure to have the Jews ostracized and persecuted. Charges the Jews killed Christians to use their blood for their ceremonies kept on recurring. Rioting broke out in the cities throughout this period, and Gentiles, who felt threatened by Jewish competition, kept on lobbying for further restrictions. These restrictions and overcrowding in the cities was beginning to make life increasingly difficult for the Jews in Poland. As the situation in the cities was getting progressively more oppressive, another avenue opened up for the Jews, which gave them even more autonomy and wealth. During the 16th century, as the power of the king began to decrease, the power of the pan, the Polish nobleman, grew. The power base of the king was centered in the large cities. The power of nobility, called the Szlachta, in the countryside. In fact, after the death of Sigismund II in 1572, the Szlachta even controlled the election of the king. We had gone through this in the last lecture. On his estate, the pan was a total ruler. In Yiddish, he was called the poritz, from the Hebrew term poritz geder, one who breaks all limitations and enclosures. Just as in the early years of their kingdom, when the kings of Poland invited the Jews to make their country economically vibrant, the nobility now gave the Jews an equally golden opportunity to run and build up the economies of their estates. And in turn, this gave the nobility the freedom to pursue their own interests and hobbies. Thus, the Jews were split between the royal Jews, centered in the big cities, and the Szlachta Jews in the countryside. Many became the personal financial agents and administrators of nobility's vast estates, and in the process became very powerful and rich, like Rav Shaul Katzenollenbogen, whom we discussed in the previous lecture. As towns sprang up in the countryside, Jews became collectors of revenues as well as shopkeepers and traders. Jews also began moving to the villages, where they became engaged in rural occupations. It seems very few Jews were engaged in agriculture. This was left to the bottom level of Polish societies, the chłopis, or serfs. Rather, the Jews became arrenders, lessees or renters, who leased the rights to the rural products of the pan, his mills, distilleries, dairies, fishing, game, and other elements of an agrarian economy. The word arrendar comes from the Latin arrendere, which means to rent. They also became keepers of the village inns, the krachma or krechma in Yiddish, which provided the only hotel accommodations in the Polish countryside. As late as 1784, an Englishman, William Cox, testified that on the whole highway between Krakow and Warsaw, extending 258 miles, the only places for the receptions of travelers were inns kept by Jews. Hand in hand with the keeping of the inns was the sale of liquor. The traffic in liquor was the cornerstone of the rural economy and an important source of tax revenue. The right of distilling had been accorded the nobles in the year 1496. The latter were anxious to promote its consumption, and their natural customers were the serfs. The Jew, who was the innkeeper, also became the tavern keeper and provided the means for the poor serf to drown his misery through the alcohol provided by the nobleman and his agent, the Jew. In the year 1569, Lithuania merged completely with Poland. This merger brought the immense southeastern frontier provinces of the Ukraine, Podolia, and Volyn, known as Little Russia, which was formerly controlled by Lithuania, to close contact with central Poland. If you'd like to see the map, you know, which you just turn on the back of the of your handouts, just you'll see this is where Podolia is, you know, on the map. It's like straight in the middle. You see Nimirov, Bar, Tulchin, Uman. See that? This is on the right of that is Ukraine. Little Russia is really this whole area. The religion of the native populace was Greek Orthodox. They were of a more warlike spirit than the Polish peasants, as they were constantly fighting the Tartars, or the Tatars, the Turkic natives of Crimea. Amongst the Ukrainians were a particular warlike group consisting of a mixture of Tartars and Ukrainians, many of whom were runaway serfs. They were called Cossacks, or vagabonds or robbers in Turkic, the language of the Tartars. At the end of the 16th century, the Ukraine became colonized by the Polish Pans, the nobility, who sent their agents, many of them Jews, to settle the land that were now owned and to collect this produce from the native Ukrainians. And basically, the Ukraine was plundered. In addition, there was a concerted effort on behalf of the Catholic Polish clergy to convert the Greek Orthodox populace. All of this was severely resented by the Ukrainians, who by nature were less docile than their Polish counterparts. In order to win over the most violent of the Ukrainians, the Cossacks, and wean them from their life of crime, the Polish government enlisted them to defend the frontiers of the Ukraine from attack by the Tatars, the natives of the Crimean Peninsula. The Cossacks were organized into divisions, each one numbering 1,000 and each headed by a captain. Their commander-in-chief was known as the Hetman. He was appointed directly by the Polish king. Several privileges were conferred upon these Cossacks, and some were even given titles of nobility. But the Polish government could not accommodate all the Cossacks into their service. Only 30,000 were in governmental employ. Another group of them lived beyond the settlement, beyond the Dnieper Falls. And this technically belonged to Poland, but really Poland was not in control of that area. They were known as the Zaporozhia, meaning beyond the falls. In other words, we're beyond that area of the Dnieper, which was really not navigable and therefore was really inaccessible to the Polish government. Despite the Polish government's efforts to mainstream this group, as well as make them farmers, they themselves, the Zaporozhian Cossacks, preferred a life of adventure and maintained themselves mainly from fishing and hunting, as well as piracy on the Black Sea. In this lecture, we'll be quoting widely from Rav Nosson Nota Hanover's classic work, Yevein HaMatsula, or The Mire of the Deep Water. According to the Talmud and Erevin and Yutessa Medalla for 19a, Kit HaYoven, the mire, is synonymous with Gehenna. In other words, it's a word which is used to describe hell. As we will see, it is quite an apt description of the events we will be relating tonight. Rav Hanover described the situation in the Ukraine right before the year 1648 as follows. He lived there in that general area, and we're going to be quoting his personal experiences as well. He lived through this period. Here, on the first page of the lecture notes, the king, this is Sigismund III, was a kind and upright man. He loved justice and loved Israel. In his days, the religion of the Pope, meaning Catholicism, gained strength in the Kingdom of Poland. Formerly, most of the local dukes and the ruling nobility adhered to the Greek Orthodox faith. Thus, the followers of both faiths were treated with equal regard. King Sigismund, however, raised the status of the Catholic dukes and princes above those of the Ukrainians, so that most of the latter, in other words, the Ukrainian nobility, the landowners, abandoned their Greek Orthodox faith and embraced Catholicism. And the masses that followed the Greek Orthodox Church became gradually impoverished. They were looked upon as lowly, inferior beings and became the slaves and the handmaids of the Polish people and of the Jews. Those amongst them who were trained warriors were conscripted by the king to serve in his army. This group numbered approximately 30,000 fighting men, and they were called Cossacks. They were exempt from taxes to the king and the nobles. It was their specific task to guard the frontier which bordered the province of Little Russia and the kingdom of the Tatars, and to protect the country against attack from the latter. For the Tatars had always been a quote-unquote stone of stumbling and a rock of offense to the kingdom of Poland. There always existed an abiding enmity between the Tatars and the Ukrainians, resulting in continuous warfare between them. The Cossacks therefore enjoyed special privileges like the nobility and were exempt from taxes. The rest of the Ukrainians, however, were wretched and enslaved lot, servants to the dukes and the nobles. The nobles levied upon them heavy taxes, and some even resorted to cruelty and torture with the intent of persuading them to accept the Catholicism. So wretched and lowly had they become that all classes of people, even the lowliest among them, referring to the Jews, became their overlords. So really he's describing a situation where the Jew himself got in a situation where he himself was part of this system of cruelty. And again, the Jews felt forced for economic reasons. They had very little recourse. The first intimation of the precarious situation of the Jews in the Ukraine was in the year 1602, when the Ukrainians first began to throw off the yoke of Polish oppression. This is what Rev. Hanover writes. In the year 5362, 1602, the 17th year of the reign of King Sigismund III, there arose a Ukrainian priest by the name of Nalevayko. May his name be blotted out. To avenge the cruel treatment accorded his people. He exhorted his people with the following words, quote, "How long will you keep silent the cruelties perpetrated by the Polish people?" End quote. Gathering a large army of Ukrainians, he staged a rebellion against the Kingdom of Poland and conquered all of Little Russia up to the city of Kudnov. When the king was apprised of this, he sent generals with all of his armies, equipped with chariots and riders. This is really a translation of a Hebrew expression. And as he sent his cavalry to wage war against Nalevayko. The Polish army prevailed, and they captured the enemy Nalevayko alive, and it continues on. The Cossacks who supported him were punished by having the number of their privilege reduced to 20,000. The rest were compelled to pay taxes to the king and the nobles. Now, it was from 30,000, now it was reduced to 20,000. It would seem, by the fact that Nalevayko's name is accompanied by a curse, you know, Yamach Shemoy, may his name be blotted out, the many Jews suffered in this rebellion. King Sigismund III died in the year 1632. He was succeeded by his son Vladislav. Rav Hanover only has good things to say about him. But this period of calm was again pierced by a second Cossack rebellion, which brought suffering to the Jews. In the words of Rav Hanover on page 2, paragraph C, in the seventh year of Vladislav's reign, in the year 5399, 1639, there arose a Cossack named Pavliuk, may his name be blotted out, to avenge the wrong of his people and to rebel against the kingdom of Poland. And many rabble and riffraff gathered of themselves unto him. They crossed the passages of the Black Sea beyond the Dnieper Falls. Each time the Ukrainians rebelled, they fled to this place, for no man came there save the Cossacks. No sooner had the adventurer arrived there, referring to Pavlius, than hundreds and thousands of Cossacks and Ukrainians came to join him. They then planned together to blot out the name of Israel, God forbid. They also partitioned the kingdom of Poland amongst themselves. That was before they conquered them. Pavlik was to be their king in the capital city of Warsaw. They destroyed many synagogues and killed approximately 200 Jews. They also destroyed many churches and killed many priests. The Polish people struck an effective blow, and the oppressor Pavlik was captured alive together with his officers and advisors. Of the 20,000 Cossacks which prior to this rebellion had enjoyed special privileges, only 6,000 were to receive them now. while the remainder were to be subject to taxes like the rest of the wretched Ukrainians. To prevent another rebellion, he placed over them captains of the Polish army. So you have a sense of what's happening, the suffering of the Ukrainians, which he, Hanover, sympathizes with, you know, and the situation, you know, with the tenseness. In other words, they were taken advantage of economically. They were discriminated against because of their religion. There's tremendous force to convert them, which was not successful. So it's tremendous hatred that was welled up amongst the Ukrainians. But all of this was merely a warning, these two events that we just described. The events we're about to describe rival, if not succeed, all the cumulative suffering that the Jews experienced throughout the Crusades, the Rhineflation, Armaleder massacres, and the Black Plague. It was an event almost without parallel in recent Jewish history, and almost certainly a realistic preview of the tortures of the Holocaust. In some ways, it was much worse than the Holocaust. The perpetrator of these horrors was a Cossack by the name of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. This is how Rav Hanover describes him. This is on page 2. In the year 5408, 1648, the 16th year of the reign of King Vladislav, there lived a Cossack in the town of Chehirin. It's really in the Ukrainian it's Chehirin, in the Russian it's Chegirin. There, the H is a G. And his name in Russian was Bogdan Chmiel, may his name be blotted out, while in Polish he was Chmielnytsky. He was one of the officers of the hundreds, the Sotsky, of the Cossacks. He was very rich, possessing sheep and oxen, and a very large multitude of cattle. He was an evil genius, a man of sinister design and a fierce warrior. His place of residence was Chehirin, which was under the rule of General Konietzpolski. The general was aware of this man and of his manner of speech. And as we're speaking of this already, is at a time where the Polish officers were really the heads of the Cossacks. They no longer were independent. While he was soft-spoken, referring to Khmelnytsky, he had, quote-unquote, seven abominations in his heart. A man plotting iniquity in the manner of all of the Ukrainians, would first appear to the Jews as friends and speak them pleasant and comforting words, beguiling them with soft and kind speech, while they lie with their tongues and are deceitful and untrustworthy. Historians tell a story of how the assistant governor of Chehirin, Daniel Chaplinsky, quarreled with Khmelnytsky over the hand of a maiden by the name of Helena. Because Helena finally chose Khmelnytsky, Chaplinsky sought his revenge by seizing Khmelnytsky's estate, killing Khmelnytsky's son in the process. He also carried off Helena and eventually married her. Despite all his efforts, Khmelnytsky was unable to achieve justice through the Polish authorities. Embittered, he began plotting a revolt. With Hanover, apparently unaware of this story, described another set of events that led to the revolt. He told the story of how the previously named General Konietzpolski, on his deathbed, warned his son, a nobleman known as Chironzny, which means the king's banner bearer, to guard against Khmelnytsky because he was very dangerous, and at that he should devise some pretext and have him killed. Later, on a visit to Chehirin, after being told of Khmelnytsky's wealth, this Chironzny reminded himself of what his father had told him about Khmelnytsky. Rationalizing that an unscrupulous man like Khmelnytsky had probably become wealthy by plundering his father's estates, Chironzny expropriated many hundreds of heads of cattle from Khmelnytsky's herd, depleting his stock by a half. Khmelnytsky did not react at that time, but decided to take his revenge later. Around that time, Chironzny decided to have some fun, and together with the Cossacks, he planned to raid a Tartar settlement and carry off the spoils. These stories, by the way, give us some inkling of the level of morality of the people with whom we are dealing, both Poles and Cossacks. Khmelnytsky decided that now was the time to take revenge, and he secretly wrote a letter to the Tartars, informing them of Hrozny's plans. After Hrozny and his Cossacks had entered Tatar territory, were about to launch their attack, they were met by a superior Tatar force and embarrassingly had to beat a hasty retreat. Only later did he find out that Khmelnytsky was the real cause of this. This is how Rav Hanover describes the story here on the bottom page 2 in paragraph B. In that city of Shahiran, there lived the Jew Zacharia Sobolensky, who was its governor administrator. He was a nobleman's tax farmer, as was the customary occupation of most Jews in the kingdom of Little Russia. For they ruled in every part of Little Russia, a condition which aroused the jealousy of the peasants and which was the cause of the massacres. The Jew, seated at another table of the inn, this is Zacharia Sobolensky, heard of the story of how Khmelnytsky had forewarned the Tartars that Hrozny, this is General Koniopolsky's son, was about to attack them, and Hrozny was shamefully forced to retreat against the greater Tartar force. So he was boasting on another table of the inn, and this Zacharias has heard this. Forthwith he informed the nobleman, and Khmel was put in iron chains and placed in prison awaiting his death. Although Khmelnytsky managed, on the advice of a close friend, a Jew by the name of Yakov Sobolensky, possibly a relative of Zacharias, to temporarily extricate himself, he was put back into prison by Hrozny, who instructed the Cossack officer of the city to have him executed the next day. So that Hrozny left the city, but that was his instructions. His friends and colleagues, the Cossack captains of the hundreds, managed to have him released into their custody on their guarantee. And Rav Hanover continues in the bottom here, page 2 in paragraph C, at night, all of them escaped beyond the Dnieper to the wilderness. In other words, Khmelnytsky and all of the captains. From there, they dispatched letters to the settlements where the Ukrainians dwelt, urging them to join the rebels. The Ukrainians responded, some 20,000 hoodlums joined them. At this point, Khmelnytsky was appointed Hetman, leader of the Zaporozhians. This is a whole group. They say now they're having a whole army here. And they appointed him. Now he was their head. And Rav Hanover continues the story. When the king and nobles heard of this, they dismissed it with laughter. For they said, quote, they will fall into our hands again as they did in their previous attempts, end quote. There were two previous attempts. Subsequently, two Polish generals, Potocki and Kalinowski, together with 1,000 trained troops, proceeded to the city of Korsun, where they prepared for battle. Khmel forthwith went to the king of the Tartars, together with all of his troops, and made peace with them. In other words, not only now he felt he needed another ally. They made a covenant together to wage war upon the kingdom of Poland. They also made a pact between them to divide the booty. Tartars were to appropriate the spoil in men and the prey in cattle. In other words, they would take all the men and sell them for slaves. In other words, slavery was no longer part of the ethic in Christian Europe. But the Tartars would take them to Muslim Europe and Asia, where they would be sold as slaves. And the Cossacks were to take all of the booty, such as gold, silver, and clothes. And it came to pass on Tuesday, the fourth day of the month of Sivan, in 5408, this is Shnastach, you know, in Hebrew, 1648, that the Tartars and the Ukrainians attacked by way of the forest from two sides. In other words, they attacked the Polish army. The Tartars attacked from one side and the Ukrainians from the other. The Poles attempted to escape through the forest and the hill and the valley, but they all fell into ditches which were dug for them by the Ukrainians and Tartar scouts. The Tartars and Ukrainians had completely surrounded them. The Polish generals then implored them not to spill their blood on earth, the earth, but to take them captive. The Tartars granted their request and took captive of the whole Polish army together with its two generals. They tortured them and placed iron chains upon the feet of the two generals, Potocki and Kalinowski. And we continue on in paragraph B. When many of the Polish magnates became aware of the Khmel's successes, and that his plans held out promise for future successes, they too rebelled against the kingdom of Poland and made an alliance with Chmiel. Now this petty nobility went to Chmielnicki's side. The same day in which the Polish army and its two generals were captured and also brought the evil tidings that King Władysław died, and the whole kingdom of Poland became a sheep which had no shepherd. So there was no one to lead the armies now. All the nobles who governed the provinces beyond the Dnieper and west of the Dnieper up to the city of Polonia fled for their lives. And it continues on. In the midst of all the confusion, Duke Wisniewski, of blessed memory, with his army was stationed beyond the Dnieper. He was a friend of Israel and unsurpassed as a war hero. He and his people escaped by way of Lithuania, and with him escaped some 500 Jewish citizens, each one with his wife and children. The defeat of the Polish army was a signal for all of the Ukrainians to rise up in rebellion, and in the most savage and vile manner, took out all of their anger on the Jews. These cruelties are almost without parallel. This is how Reb Hanover described them, from the bottom of page 3, paragraph, section 4. The Jews on this side of the Dnieper were informed of these terrible events on the first day of the festival of the Shavuos. All of them took flight on that day, unmindful of their gold and silver. They ran for their lives. All those in the provinces of Ostrog, as well as those over which Ostro, had jurisdiction, such as Biala, Cherkiev, Pavloch, Kudnov, and Lebartov, and also the communities over which they had jurisdiction, all of them fled. Some ran to Polonia, some to Zaslav, some to Ostro, the capital, and to Stary Konstantinov. For these were fortified cities. In other words, so they were all in the areas without fortification, and they ran for the place of safety. All of those in the provinces of the city of Lvov, in the kingdom of Little Russia, and the communities belonging to them, such as the environs of Nemirov, as you look on the back of your handouts, you can see many of these in the middle of the thing. You see Nemirov, escape to Nemirov, those of the environs of Bar, you see Bar to the left of Nemirov, such as Vinnytsia, and Starigrod, and Krasny, all the communities adjacent to them fled to the city of Bar. Whoever failed to escape or was unable to escape was killed. Many communities beyond the Dnieper and close to the battlefield, such as Periaslav, Barashovka, Piratin, Boroshpola, Lubin, and Lachovice, and their neighbors who were unable to escape, perished for the sanctification of his name. These persons died cruel and bitter deaths. Some were skinned alive and their flesh was thrown to the dogs. Some had their hands and limbs chopped off and their bodies thrown on the highway, only to be trampled by wagons and crushed by horses. Some had wounds inflicted upon them and were thrown on the street to die a slow death. They writhed in their blood until they breathed their last. Others were buried alive. The enemy slaughtered infants in the laps of their mothers. They were sliced into pieces like fish. They slashed the bellies of pregnant women, removed their infants, and tossed them into their faces. Some women had their bellies torn open and live cats placed in them. The bellies were then sewn up with live cats remaining inside. They chopped off their hands of the victims so they would not be able to remove the cats from their bellies. The infants were hung on the breasts of their mothers. Some children were pierced with spears, roasted on the fire, then brought to their mothers to be eaten. Many times they used the bodies of Jewish children as improvised bridges upon which they later crossed. There was no cruel device of murder in the whole world that was not perpetrated by the enemies. All the four death penalties, stoning, burning, beheading, and strangling, were meted out to the Jews. Many were taken by the Tartars into captivity. Women and virgins were ravished. They lay with the women in the presence of their husbands. They seized comely women as handmaids and housekeepers, some as wives and concubines. Similar atrocities were perpetrated in all of the settlements through which they passed. Also against the Polish people, these cruelties were perpetrated, especially against priests and bishops. Thus, westward of the Dnieper, several thousand Jewish persons perished. Several hundred were forced to change their faith. Scrolls of the Torah were torn to pieces and turned into boots and shoes for their feet. The straps of the tefillin served as laces around their feet. The leather boxes of the tefillin were cast into the streets. Other sacred books served to pave the streets. Some were used for kindling purposes, others to stuff the barrels of their guns. The ears ring at the hearing of this. It is interesting to contrast, though, the Ukrainians with the Tartars. This is here on the bottom of page 4. When the king, the Jews of Pogrebiche, of Zivotov, in Pajayovka, in Tetyuv, and their surroundings, heard of what the Ukrainians had perpetrated against our brethren beyond the Dnieper, that the Tartars and the Ukrainians surrounded them, that the Tartars on one side of the Ukrainians on the other, they said, if we wait until the Ukrainians invade the city, we'll perish and be forced into baptism, God forbid. It is preferable that we fall captives to the Tartars. For we know that our brethren Constantinople and the other Turkish communities are very compassionate, and they will ransom us. This they did. The four above mentioned communities surrendered to the Tartars, men, women, and children, some 3,000 souls. Among them was a Chazan, Reb Hirsch of Zivotov. When the Tartars came into the city, began to chant mournfully the memorial prayer, Kael Mole Rachamim, on behalf of our slaughtered brethren of the house of Israel. All the people burst forth with intense weeping. Apparently their cries ascended on high, for the compassion of the captors was stirred. They consoled them with expressions of sympathy and said to them, quote, do not despair and do not deny yourselves food and drink. There are shochtim, ritual slaughterers among you. Let them kill an abundance of sheep and oxen for your need, and forthwith will bring you to your brethren in Constantinople to be ransomed. The Tartars kept their promise. Our brethren in Constantinople, may Hashem preserve them, redeem them together with other Polish captives, numbering approximately 20,000 souls. They expended vast sums of money, all that was asked of them. They provided food and shelter for them to the present day. In other words, he wrote this shortly after these events of Hanover. They favored them with many services without limit. The entire land of Turkey manifested such generosity, especially the people of Salonika, may Hashem preserve them. They ransomed a large number of captives. The renowned city of Venice, the crown city of Rome, and the beloved and laudable city of Livorno, as well as other holy communities of Italy contributed many thousands and tens of thousands of gold pieces, which were forwarded to Greater Constantinople for the ransoming of captives. May Hashem recompense these good people for their kindness shown to our brethren of the house of Israel and keep them from evil until the coming of the Redeemer. After the first onslaught, the Cossacks regrouped, but Poland was not yet prepared to counterattack. And here we have on page 5, following these events, the Tartars returned to their land with all their prize, and the Presser Chamil, together with his Cossack troops and many thousands of Tartars who had remained with him, went to the city of Chehvina. He addressed himself to his servants, his ministers and advisors, and said to them, quote, when the Catholic kings will hear of the evil we have perpetrated, they will make war upon us, and we are but few in number. They replied to him, quote, send letters to the Polish nobility and dukes. Tell them that you regret all you have done, that all was imperative in order to save yourself. This you must do so that they will not mobilize troops against us speedily. Meanwhile, send messengers to the king of the Tartars to supply with additional troops. Also send letters to all Ukrainians in the kingdom of Poland to be prepared for the appointed time to gather themselves on their enemies, the nobles and the Jews. End quote. And this he did. When the thing became known to the Jews through their friendly Ukrainian neighbors and also through their own spies when placed in all their settlements, they notified their lords, the nobles. Immediately messages were sent forth from the community to community by means of horse riders informing the Jews and the nobles of daily developments. Had not been for this action, there would have been no escape for the remnant of Israel, God forbid. Meanwhile, Chamil sent messages to the dukes and nobles, words of peace. He wrote them words of comfort and sympathy. He also advised the nobles to return to their homes, and he would return their estates to them. But the nobles paid no heed to his messages, for they understood that all was falsehood and deceit. He was merely seeking to ensnare. The cardinal, whose seat was Gniezno, was regent. He was the temporary king. Because of the king's death, this cardinal was the brother of the king. So that the Poland should not be without government. The cardinal announced under threat of punishment throughout Poland that all nobles should mobilize to wreak vengeance on their enemies. Unfortunately, they assembled very slowly, as was characteristic of the Kingdom of Poland. I just want you to see where Nimrod is, see on the map, and how far it is from the Dnieper, and how far we see that they were moving now. The oppressor Chamiel, may his name be blotted out, heard that many Jews had gathered in the holy community of Nemrut. They had a great deal of silver and gold with them. Accordingly, Chamiel sent a leader, an enemy of the Jews, and about 600 swordsmen with him to attack this noble community. In addition, he wrote to the city heads to help the band. The city leaders readily responded to give them their full cooperation. This they did not so much because of the love of the Cossacks, because of their hatred of the Jews. It came to pass on Wednesday, the 20th of Sivan, that was June the 10th, 1648, the Cossacks approached the city of Nemrut. When the Jews saw the troops from afar, their hearts trembled from fright, though they were not certain as yet whether they were Polish or Cossacks. Nevertheless, all the Jews went with their wives and children, with their silver and gold, in the fortress, locked and barred the gates, and prepared to fight with them. What did those evildoers, the Cossacks, do? They devised flags like those of the Poles, for there was no way to distinguish between the Polish and the Cossack forces except through their banners. The people of the city were fully aware of this trickery, and nevertheless called to the Jews in the fortress, "Open the gate! There's a Polish army which has come to save you from the hands of your enemies. Should they come?" End quote. Immediately they opened the gate. No sooner had the gates been opened than the Cossacks entered with drawn swords, spears, and scythes, and some only with clubs, and they killed the Jews in large numbers. Women and young children were ravished, but some of the women and maidens jumped into the moat surrounding the fortress in order that the uncircumcised should not defile them. They drowned in the waters. Many of them who were able to swim jumped into the water believing they would escape the slaughter, but the Ukrainians swam after them with their swords and their scythes and killed them in the water. Some of the enemy shot with their guns into the water and killed them, and so the water became red with the blood of the slain. The head of the yeshiva, the rabbinical academy of Nemrut, was also there. His name was Moreno Rabbeinu, is our master and teacher, the rabbi of Michiel Mechel, son of His Excellency, our teacher of Eliezer of blessed memory. He knew the whole of the rabbinic writings by heart, was proficient in all of the worldly sciences. On the Sabbath before the catastrophe, he preached and admonished the people that if the enemy should come, God forbid, they should not change their faith, but rather be martyred for the sanctification of his name. This the holy people did. He also jumped into the water, believing that he would save himself by swimming, when the Ukrainians seized him and wanted to slay him. But the scholar implored him not to kill him, for which he would compensate him with a great deal of gold and silver. The Ukrainian consented, and he led him to the house where his gold and silver were hidden, and the Cossack released him. The rabbi then left the place with his mother, and the two hid in a certain house all the night until the morning dawn. On the morrow, the Ukrainians searched their houses, suspecting the Jews might be hidden there. The rabbi and his mother then fled to the cemetery. Thus, should they be killed, they would receive burial. But it so happened that when they came near the cemetery, a Ukrainian shoemaker, one of the townspeople, pursued the rabbi with club in hand and inflicted on him wounds. The rabbi's mother pleaded with the Ukrainians to be killed instead of the son, but the latter paid no attention and proceeded to kill first the rabbi, then the mother. May God avenge their blood. 3 days after the massacre, the rabbi's wife buried him, for in the town where the slaughter took place, the majority of the women were spared, except for the old and feeble who were killed. It happened there that a beautiful maiden of a renowned and wealthy family had been captured by a certain Cossack, who forced her to be his wife. But before they lived together, she told him with cunning that she possessed a certain magic and that no weapon could harm her. She said to him, quote, "If you do not believe me, just test me. Shoot at me with a gun and you will see that I will not be harmed," end quote. The Cossack, her husband, in his simplicity, thought that she was telling the truth. He shot at her with his gun and she fell dead for the sanctification of his name. To avoid being defiled by him, may God avenge her blood. Another event occurred when a beautiful girl about to be married to a Cossack insisted that their marriage take place in a church which stood across a bridge. He granted her request and with timbrels and flutes, attired in festive garb, led her to the marriage. As soon as they came to the bridge, she jumped into the water and was drowned for the sanctification of the name. May Hashem avenge her of the blood. These and many similar events took place, far too numerous to be recorded. The number of slain and drowned in the holy community of Nemirov was about 6,000. Because you have to realize not only were they from the city of Nemirov, but from all the adjacent areas had come for safety, if it would need be to go into the fortress. Those of the holy community of Nemirov who escaped the sword fled to the holy community of Tulchin, for there, outside the city, was a strong fortress. And you can see on the map, due south of Nemirov, is Tulchin. And he continues on with Hanover. And it came to pass after the evil doings in the holy community of Nemirov, that a band of 10,000 men, scoundrels and hooligans, assembled together under the leadership of the oppressor of the Jews, Maxim Krizhvonos. May his name and memory be blotted out. They proceeded from there to the holy community of Tulchin. For there in the fortress were assembled some 600 Polish troops. With them were gathered some 2,000 Jews. Among them were also trained soldiers and seasoned warriors. The Jews and the nobles made a covenant to help each other in the struggle against their common enemy and took an oath not to betray one another. They reinforced the fort and armed with all kinds of weapons. The Jews and nobles took their posts on the ramparts. Continues on after a lapse of several days. Ukrainians took counsel together and agreed to send a peace offer to the nobles in the fortress. They would conclude a truce on condition the Jewish spoil be delivered to them as a ransom for their lives. The nobles immediately agreed to accept the offer. They sent for the Jews to disarm them one by one until they were all disarmed. The Jews understood the trickery and wanted to attack the nobles first, since they were first to betray the covenant. But the Rosh Yeshiva of the Holy Communion of Tulchin, the scholar, our teacher and master of Aaron, cried aloud to the Jews, quote, "Hearken, my brethren, my people, we are in exile amongst the nations. If you lay a hand upon the nobles, and the Catholic kings will hear of this, they will wreak vengeance upon our brethren in exile, God forbid. Therefore, if our fate be decreed from heaven, let us accept the judgment with rejoicing. We are not worthier than our brethren of the Holy Communion of Nemirov." And the Jews hearkened to him. Just as an aside, I know Rabbi Friedman, Olav HaShalom, had pointed out to me on several occasions that after the Warsaw Ghetto uprising, all the other ghettos were immediately liquidated and all the people immediately killed. And I don't know who he was quoting from. He was saying about the difficulty, of creating an uprising when that uprising was really the cause of the immediate deaths of so many other Jews. But it's just that way of thinking really is, here in this in the city of Tulchin. Because basically they could have saved themselves, or at least something, or at least not died, sheep to the slaughter. But they had in mind that if they'll rise up, who knows how many other Jews will be killed. No sooner did the Ukrainians enter than the leader of the nobles, Duke Cherchinsky, said to them, quote, "Behold, here is the prize that you requested," and all of the and they took from them all of the Jews, all of their possessions, their gold and silver, but they let the Jews live temporarily. And they were put under the custody, the Jews, of the Polish nobility, the Jews shouldn't run away. And it continues on, after these things, one of their intermediaries appeared and planted a banner in the ground, and he said in a loud voice, this is one of the Cossacks, "Whoever wishes to change his faith and remain alive, let him sit under this banner." No one answered him. Thus he announced three times, and no one responded. Immediately, the gate of the garden opened, and the infuriated mob rushed in and killed a large number of Jews. Approximately 1,500 souls perished by all sorts of terrible deaths. But he continues on, Rav Hanover, after the slaughter of the Jews, they proceeded to attack the fortress. And the nobles said to them, "Behold, you made an agreement with us. Why do you repudiate your pledge?" And the Ukrainians replied, "As you did unto the Jews, breaking your promise to them, so shall we do unto you, measure for measure." End quote. When those stationed on the wall began to shoot, the Ukrainians cunningly set the fortress afire, killing all the nobles and countless others. As they did, so did God repay them, because they violated the pledge of the Jews. When the nobles heard of this, they were stricken with remorse, and henceforth supported the Jews, did not deliver them into the hands of the depraved. Even though the Ukrainians repeatedly promised the nobles immunity, they no longer believed them. Were it not for this, there would have been no escape for the remnants of the Jews, God forbid. I just want you to see on the map, they went up where Polonia is on the map. Polonia, if you follow the river here, I mean, just follow this, really it's, it would be northwest here, above the line of latitude, you see Polonia. And again, the hordes, you know, proceeded to Polonia. Among the martyrs of the holy city of Polonia was a wise and understanding, divinely inspired Kabbalist, Rav Shimshon of Ostropolia. An angel would appear to him every day, a Maggid, and to teach him the mysteries of the Torah. This mystic composed a commentary on the Zohar based on the Kabbalah of the Arizal, but it was never published. The angel had told him prior to the massacre to indulge in sincere repentance so that the evil decree will not come to pass. He preached frequently in the synagogue and exhorted the people to repent so that the evil would not come to pass. Accordingly, all the communities repented sincerely, but not avail, for the evil decree had already been sealed. When the enemies and the oppressors invaded the city, the above-mentioned mystic and 300 of the most prominent citizens, all dressed in tachrichim, shrouds with talasim, prayer shawls over their heads, like on Yom Kippur, entered the synagogue and engaged in fervent prayer. When the enemies arrived, they killed all of them upon the sacred ground of the synagogue. May God avenge their blood. Many hundreds who managed to survive were forced to change their faith. Many hundreds were taken captives by the Tartars. During the beginning of the uprising, Hanover himself was in the city of Zaslav, only 6 miles away from Polonia. Although his history, for the most part, is based upon reports that he received, as he wasn't there in Nemirov or Tulshin, the following section describes Rav Hanover's own personal account. We were informed on page 9 in the holy city of Zaslav that the Tartars and the Ukrainians were besieging the holy community of Polonia. Zaslav was only 6 miles from Polonia. On that Thursday, whoever was able to flee, fled. We abandoned our homes, which were filled with merchandise and books and other good things. We did not spare our possessions. We only thought of saving ourselves and our sons and daughters. Some escaped to the capital city of Ostrov. I fled to the holy community of Midyechereche, 2,000 cubits from Ostrov. No, this was really very close, a half a mile, the capital. In the community of Ostrog and its adjacent community of Miedzerachea lived more than 10,000 householders. Vuk Visnievetsky and 1,000 warriors arrived. The great hero Lajaj and the rest of his army followed. There was great rejoicing amongst us. And as they felt already, they had the Polish army on their side and they were able to repel the Cossacks. We thought we would return to our homes after Shabbos Chazon. Chazon is the Shabbos right before Tisha B'Av. We were only 4 miles distant from the holy community of Zaslav. On Sabbath Eve, we were stunned by the evil tidings which reach us. The noble Vizotsky, who was the governor of Polonia, had fled. He said, quote, "Polonia has been captured. All the nobles and the Jews therein were murdered. The enemy's onslaught is reaching Zaslav. Duke Visnievetsky, together with his troops, fled to Konstantinov. If you'll notice this on the map, due south of Polonia is Old Constantine. This Constantine. And the Tartars and Ukrainians are pursuing them. Some of them are marching towards Ostrov and Mydietsrychia. The mass of people were under the erroneous impression that the general, Duke Dominic, escaped to the Kingdom of Poland. However, Duke Dominic's army were actually awaiting close by for reinforcements. And as they thought that the situation was worse, it was bad, but they thought it was worse than it actually was. The heads of the community of Ostrog announced that no Jew should dare to remain in that community, nor for that matter in the community of Mydietsrychia, for the enemy is only 2 miles distance from us. All the people fled in accordance with the announcement. Whoever had a horse and cart traveled in it. Those who did not possess a horse and cart, even though they had sufficient money to buy them, would not wait, but took wife and children by hand and fled on foot, casting away all belongings. On that Shabbos Chazon, 3 rows of horses and carts moving along, one next to the other in width, and for a stretch of 7 miles, the entire distance between Ostrog and the Holy Communion of Dubnov in length. The road was cluttered with horses and carts, one behind the other, and innumerable pedestrians. Within 2 hours on that Shabbos Chazon, 3 horse riders, one Jew, his name was Moshe Tzorov of Ostrog, and the 2 nobles ran after us. They said to us, "Why are you marching so slowly? Behold, the enemy is close behind us. They are now in Mydietsrychia. We escaped with difficulty." Immediately, there was such confusion and panic among our brethren of the house of Israel that it was indescribable. Everyone threw from his cart silver and gold, vessels and books, pillows and bed covers in order to be able to escape more quickly to save the lives of his family. The field was cluttered with gold, silver, and clothes, and no Jews paused to take them. This time the admonishing words of the prophet came true, "They shall cast their silver in the streets." Some cast away everything, horse and cart and all that was in it, and only wife and children fled for their lives in the woods. Many women and men who had led their children by the hands released them when this panic seized them, ran for their lives in the woods and into the pits. Thus the verse of Leviticus came true, "And you shall flee where none pursues you," for it was all a falsehood. The enemies, the Tartars, did not pursue us. On the Sunday following Shabbos Chazon, the truth became known to us. Then the anxiety was relieved, and from that day on, everyone slackened his pace. We walked from place to place through cities and villages, sleeping in the streets. Eventually, Hanover was able to make his way to Germany in safety. Kept on going. But for the Jews that remained, it was only the beginning of their sorrows, their troubles. None of the cities were able to withstand the onslaught of the Cossack and their Tartar allies. After destroying the remaining Jews of Vyazoslav and Ostrov, the Ukrainians attacked Konstantinov, which was defended by Duke Vishnyevetsky. After initial gains, he was forced to retreat, leaving the city to the Ukrainian mobs. They came in on Tisha B'Av. 3,000 Jews were killed there that day. With the help of their Tartar allies, the Ukrainians drove out the entire Polish army and proceeded to continue their plunder. The Jews in their path kept on running away to fortified areas. Many were not so fortunate and were brutally murdered by the Ukrainians. After conquering Little Russia and killing the remaining Jews there, they moved on to Lithuania. Major communities like Brisk, Brest-Litovsk, Pinsk, Slutsk, Homo were all captured by the Ukrainians. According to Rav Hanover, many tens of thousands of Jews were killed in Lithuania. But the Ukrainians were not always successful. In some cities, such as Brod, the Jews and Polish nobility were able to defend themselves in the city's well-built fortress. Unfortunately, plague broke out during the siege, killing approximately 1,000 Jews. In Lvov, after a long siege that took a serious toll, 10,000 people died from starvation and disease alone. The Cossacks struck a deal with the defenders and gave the Cossacks an enormous fortune in gold and silver to make them agree to leave and lift the siege. They were able to repeat this tactic a number of times in different cities. These sieges took a tremendous toll in lives lost through starvation and disease. Eventually, Poland chose a new king, John Casimir, the brother of the recently deceased Władysław, who had been a cardinal. Notice, he had been a regent, and then he was elected king. As soon as he took office, he persuaded Khmelnytsky to return home with his army and told him he'd work out terms with him at a later date. After the Cossacks returned home, negotiations with Khmelnytsky began, but soon broke down. As a result, in the spring of 1649, hostilities resumed once more. After a succession of battles in which the Poles were defeated, in August of 1649, a treaty was concluded with the Tartars, as well as a tentative agreement that was quite favorable to the Cossacks and forbade any Jews to live in the area occupied by them. On their way back home, the Tartars devastated the land. As they really did, they hated the Ukrainians. And just this was a this was an arrangement of convenience. The cities of Ostrog and its environs, 20 square miles, were burned, and tens of thousands of Ukrainians were killed or taken captivity. In the words of Rav Hanover, quote, "And the Lord avenged on them the vengeance of the people of Israel. They themselves accepted it as a just punishment," end quote. As the Ukrainians viewed it, that their suffering was because of the suffering they had meted out to the Jews. Describing the condition of Jewry at that time, Rav Hanover tells us the following, from page 10. "So similarly, slaughters took place in many other communities, the fury of which cannot be recorded. Thus they devastated more than 700 communities, all the cities and settlements up to the Vistula River." You see on your map where the Vistula is, which is like on the left third of the page. Vistula goes through Warsaw. So anything, there's anything east of that was all devastated by the Cossacks. "Among those Jews who had escaped across the Vistula River, a terrible plague broke out. They cast their dead on the cemetery in the darkness of the night, so that their unfriendly neighbors might not notice and delight that when they beheld a new grave. The plague was different from any other plague. They were stricken with a high fever, result of the trying journey and the fright. Many poor people and the Gentiles did not permit entry into their homes, had to sleep in the streets. They died of starvation and exposure. No man offered aid to his brother, and no father took pity on his child. More than 100,000 Jews perished of this disease. May the Lord preserve and save us." There's a question of historians in terms of the reliability of these numbers. And really there's a question amongst historians how many people died throughout this whole period. And the numbers vary between 100,000 and 600,000, which basically meant there was like the total devastation of all of those Jews in this. "And the Jews became impoverished. The balance of silver and golden garments which they managed to retain, they sold for half their value. Silk and the other garments were one third of their value. Books were worthless, for there was no buyer. The Torah lay in a deserted corner, for the Gentiles bought only silver and gold and garments. After Sukkot 5410, 1649, and that's when they speak about the slaughter, they speak about Shnaf Tach V'Tat. Tach is tough, is 400, and Ches is 8, and this is 5,000, right? It says and 409. So already now we're in Sukkot afterwards of 410, which is still 1649. The Polish nobles returned to their homes and to their estates. Also the remnants of Israel, orphans of orphans, is returned. Yasma the Yasma. They were destitute and poor, and they found no respite even there, because prices were high and food was scarce. For the Ukrainian people, thousands and tens of thousands perished from starvation. And the famine for bread was not so great as the lack of money, for the Cossacks and Tartars had robbed them of all of their money and treasures. The wretched Jews, however, though indigent and destitute, appeared in the eyes of the multitude and of the nobles as rich people. They were compelled to give exorbitant taxes, so that nothing remained in their hands, and their poverty grew worse from day to day. Nevertheless, they offered praise and thanks to the Holy One, blessed be He, for the peace which they enjoyed. And it continues on, "In those days the king, may his glory increase," this is John Casimir, "issued an ordinance throughout the province of his kingdom that whoever had been forced to change his faith may return to his former faith. All the forced converts returned to Judaism, and the Jews continued to reside in all the cities where they had been converted. Also, the women whom the Cossacks married by force fled to the cities which were populated by Jews. In the places where severe carnage took place, hundreds of boys and girls and infants had been converted. The Jews took them back by force from the hands of the Gentiles. After thorough investigation, they provided them with identifying tags giving the names of the families to which they belonged. These were hung on the necks of each child. Many, so really they shouldn't marry their brother and sister, because they should know who they are. Many women had become agunas, women unable to marry because of the unaccounted status of their husbands, and many widows who had become subject to yibum. This is a levirate marriage. In other words, if a person dies without children, the brother of the deceased has the right to marry, you know, his sister-in-law. And unless that there is a severance of that relationship through a ceremony of chalitza, this woman really is also in limbo. And these women became agunas because of the yavam had departed the land. Everyone fled, who knows where they went. The authorities of the Council of Four Lands instituted many appropriate ordinances for their benefit and instituted a public fast for the whole kingdom of Poland to be observed on the 20th day of Sivan for generations to come, for on that day the terrible slaughter of Nemirov had occurred and had been the first community to submit to massacres for the glorification of his name. And as there were many Jews who were killed in small areas, but this was the first major, you know, major community. This peace was short-lived, however, and in 1651 hostilities began again. And he continues, it came to pass prior to Passover 5411, 1651, the Tartars and the Ukrainians assembled a fourth time. And on that Passover, the children of Israel drank the four cups of poison. They slew hundreds of Jews, and hundreds went into captivity to the Tartars. And all the children of Israel escaped to the metropolis of Lvov. The king himself went out to fight them, and with him were 300,000 able soldiers of the Polish army, and 80,000 men composed of German, French, and Spanish soldiers, also 1,000 Jewish fighters. The Tartars and the Ukrainians came upon them suddenly with their accustomed shouts and savage outcries and said, "Let us attack the Polish people and defeat them as we did in our previous attempts." End quote. The hands of the Polish army prevailed, and reinforced by the Germans, they struck a severe blow on the Tartars and Ukrainians, and they smote them, pursued them unto destruction. The Tartar king escaped to his land in great embarrassment with very few of his forces. He took the impressor Chamil with him in captivity, because the latter did not inform him of the strength of the Polish king's army. All the high-ranking officers, among them the nephew of the Tartar king, being prisoners of the Polish king. The Tartar king sent letters to the king, "May his glory increase," to release his nephew in exchange of this foe, the oppressor Chamil, who at that time had been his prisoner. The king refused. Then the king sent his two generals. They had already, in the peace agreement, those two generals who had originally been captured, were released. So now they were now heading a new army. And Duke Vishnyevetsky, and with them 150,000 able-bodied soldiers, to conquer all the Ukrainian cities in the land of Little Russia, make war on the Tartars afterwards. This they did. They proceeded and captured the cities in the land of Little Russia one by one. And it came to pass that the king of the Tartars heard that the hero, the duke, died, and the two generals were preparing to make war on him. He made peace with the oppressor Chamil. Everything is, it's interesting. Chamil paid him a ransom of 18 million gold pieces and also supported him. The Tartars and the Ukrainians assembled a fifth time to make war against Poland. The great war thus renewed itself in Poland after the Holy Days, 5412. Moreover, a severe epidemic had broken out in the Kingdom of Poland, the city of Krakow, and other communities in the Kingdom of Poland in the summer of 5412 and 1652. More than 20,000 persons perished. And it was unrelated to the hostilities. Unto the present day throughout the Kingdom of Poland, because this is really where he finishes his work, Rav Hanover, there reigns the sword, famine, and a great pestilence. And these latter troubles make us forget the former. Every day the tragedy is greater than the one on the day preceding it. Shall we say that we have not sinned? Behold, our iniquities testify against us, for we have sinned, and the Lord found out the iniquity of the servants. Since the day when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, the righteous are seized by death for the iniquities of the generation. This is how he looked. But his view was He doesn't identify what the shortcomings of the Jews were, but he views it as part of the constant pattern of history. The Jews suffer because of their shortcomings. Seeing the futility of constant war with Poland, Chmielnitsky soon began negotiations with the Russian Tsar, Alexis Mikhailovich, looking to be incorporated into Russia with the rights of an autonomous province. In 1654, incorporation was finalized. This is how the Ukraine became a province of Russia. And Russia proceeded to attack Poland's provinces of White Russia and Lithuania. Now, those Jews who were fortunate enough to be spared the horrors of Chmielnitsky, because White Russia is really very far from this area. If you see, like, if one was like on the towards the northeastern corner, you see Moscow is in one square. If you go to the left of it, you see the Volezh. You see Vitebsk, Volezh. Volezh is where my wife's grandfather, Shalom, was the Rav. This is the area. This is White Russia here. Mogilev, if you're going south here. Now, those Jews who were fortunate enough to be spared the horrors of Chmielnitsky became the latest victims. Sweden also entered the war and conquered the major cities of Poland, such as Warsaw, Krakow, and Kalisz. Again, these were areas, again, that were not touched before. After the Swedes were defeated, Polish bands claimed the Jews were traitors and helped the Protestant Swedes against the Catholic Poles, began to cruelly kill and torture the Jews. Finally, in the year 1657, peace was restored. This was for 9 years. But the impoverished Jews never returned to their former glory. We had spoken before about the Golden Age of Poland, how Torah was studied in every village, every town, was full of great scholars. That no longer was. Historians estimate that as many as 600,000 Jews were killed during this period, which you discussed before. Again, there's a question, you know, how to view the numbers. Many others fled and settled in the West, Germany, Holland, Italy, and this has really caused a renaissance in these countries. Because now you had all these people came who were educated Jews, and they really invigorated all of those areas. Morally, the Jews were decimated. Soon, though, a man claiming to be Mashiach, the Messiah, brought new excitement throughout the world. His story is the subject of the next lecture. Now, are there any questions? Yeah. He didn't, the thing about how long Chmielnitsky did, he was not killed in war. I don't recall, you know, under what circumstances he died. I believe he... Yeah, you can imagine our good friend, the Ukrainians. I mean, he is really a hero. He is the one who created Ukrainian independence. Even though they really were not become... They didn't become independent, truly, because now they became a province of Russia, and Russia didn't keep its promises very well either. So the Ukrainians then became really... subjugated by the Russians, but the Cossacks were used by the Russians again to protect the border, and they at least used them, you know, for their needs. And up until throughout the Tsarist period, the Cossacks were really the defenders of the crown.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.